From NPR News, you're listening to the podcast edition of Weekends on All Things Considered, the best picks from our programs on Saturday and Sunday. I'm Jackie Lydon. In this episode, for decades, prisons increased the number of inmates in solitary confinement.
You was in a 6x9x12 foot cell. You got an hour out the shower, and after that, you were locked up all the rest of the days.
That could be changing. Our cover story, challenging the practice of solitary confinement. Then, remember that meteor shower in Siberia? Scientists are working to keep you safe from asteroids. Also, music for those who can't hear, and celebrating the father of modern conservation, Aldo Leopold.
The things he was writing about just before his death really didn't find an audience until 25 years later.
And then, the story of two inseparable twin sisters in the memoir, Her, and the former Saturday Night Live staff writer, Emily Spivey, talks about the movie she could watch a million times. We also have a winner to announce in 3-Minute Fiction.
So who is it? Who is the winner for round 10 of 3-Minute Fiction?
Plus, a love story returns to New York the last 5 years. A musical.
If you had a tattoo, that wouldn't matter. If you had a shaved head, that would be cool.
That's all on this week's episode of Weekends on All Things Considered. An estimated 80,000 American prisoners spend 23 hours a day in closed isolation cells for 10, 20, even more than 30 years. Now, amid growing concerns over the policy, the Federal Bureau of Prisons has decided for the first time in its history to review its policies on solitary confinement. That's our cover story. When Charles Dickens visited the United States of America this very week in 1842, the two places he most wanted to see were the Falls at Niagara and a castle of a prison meant to reform incarceration itself, Eastern State Penitentiary in Philadelphia. Eastern State Penitentiary pioneered solitary confinement for every inmate back in 1829. This past week, we went there, too.
Boy, it really is a bleak day here. We didn't used to open the building in the winter at all because it's truly a ruin.
Sean Kelly, director of public programming, took us through the halls of the historic prison, now a museum. It's been preserved in a state of evocative ruin. Corridors of isolation cells radiate out like the spokes of a wheel, around a rotunda like an omniscient eye. Eastern State's first inmate was an 18-year-old African-American named Charles Williams, who served 2 years here for stealing a watch and a gold key. Sensory deprivation was intended to reform the soul. Inmates were hooded, guards wore socks over their shoes, books weren't allowed. Redemptive? Kelly tells me Dickens didn't think so.
He said, I hold the slow and daily tampering with the mysteries of the brain to be immeasurably worse than any torture of the body.
But it would be decades before Eastern State authorities changed the policy.
They believed that this isolation here was going to bring out the best in these inmates, change them for life, make them penitent.
And is there any evidence that that is indeed what happened?
There's a lot of evidence that it's not what happened.
The high cost, the questionable effectiveness, and the need for more cells led Eastern State Penitentiary to end solitary confinement by 1913. Unfortunately, by then, the practices, even the blueprint of this prison, had been copied more than 300 times around the world. In 1970, Eastern State Penitentiary, by then antiquated and overcrowded, closed its last cell door. That same year, a young man, Robert King, was convicted for robbery and taken into custody at Angola State Prison in Louisiana, beginning a sentence there that would last 32 years, 29 of them in solitary.
You was in a 6x9x12 foot cell. You got an hour out the shower, and then after that, you were locked up all the rest of the days.
We'll talk to Robert King later on, but let's go back to last summer of 2012, when Senator Dick Durbin of Illinois convened a hearing.
Good morning. This hearing, the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Human Rights will come.
Solitary confinement exploded with the law and order policies of the 1980s, when 40 states built what's called a supermax prison, in which each prisoner is held in solitary. Since then, more questions have been raised about the mental health of prisoners incarcerated this way. Senator Durbin is by now convinced it's a violation of the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment. So are you prepared to say that this does constitute a violation of the Eighth Amendment against cruel and unusual punishment?
I can tell you that in the extreme, it most certainly does.
Testifying in front of the committee was the director of the Federal Bureau of Prisons, Charles Samuels. Samuels explained the necessity of the practice to keep violent inmates apart from guards and other prisoners, and he read from a statement.
The use of any form of restricted housing, however limited, remains a critical management tool that helps us maintain safety, security, and effective reentry programming for all federal inmates.
Solitary confinement doubles or triples the cost of incarceration, up to $60,000 a year per inmate. But corrections officials, who've seen its wide use now for the last several decades, have their own evaluation of whether it does more harm than good. Here's Walter Dickey, formerly the Secretary of Corrections for Wisconsin.
I really believed when I got close to the situation at the Supermax in Wisconsin that one of the things that I was seeing was mentally ill people who didn't come in mentally ill, but the level of security, frankly, the overcrowding, even when they didn't start out in segregation, was very detrimental to their mental health and led them to act in ways that led them to get tickets, and tickets got them into segregation.
Tickets for small things lead to more segregation time. It can be an endless cycle. But Dickey says the practice should be reserved for really violent offenders.
People like that need to be isolated, at least temporarily, if not for a longer period of time, until you can release them into the population, the general population, with some confidence that they're not going to do severe damage to other people.
Increasingly, former solitary prisoners are testifying to suicidal depression, self-mutilation, lethargy, hallucinations, and other ills. At the time of his release in 2001, Robert King had been among the longest-serving solitary inmates in the country, 29 years. Together with two other men, Herman Wallace and Albert Woodfox, he's one of the Angola Three, serving over 100 years between the three of them. They've sued the state of Louisiana, but King's co-plaintiffs remain in solitary confinement.
The cells were pretty bare, and they were maybe about three feet wide and about 6 feet long. It's almost like it was in a tomb, and there was a slab of concrete that you laid on, that you slept on, and you ate. For breakfast, for meal, you had three meals a day. You had two slices of bread each meal. During the wintertime, you froze, and during the summertime, you was overheated. But in any event, you were starved.
I'd like to know about your time in solitary when you're in this CCR unit, this closed restriction unit. What was a typical day like? Could you tell me?
For me, it spanned 3 decades, so initially, when we went to CCR, you know, you were allowed any number of books, and if you could afford a radio, that was allowed. You was in a 6x9x12-foot cell. You got an hour out to shower, and then after that, you were locked up all the rest of the days. They brought your meals to your cell. I mean, that practice continued, except that it was kind of modified a little bit. At a certain point, depending on whichever administration came in, because over that period of time, you have a number of people go and come. And at one time, like I said, we were allowed any number of books, but came a period of time when they kind of minimized that to 6 books. You could say 4, because a dictionary and a Bible was something that was considered one of the books that you would have. You was allowed to have 4 other books. And at one point, we wasn't allowed to go on a yard. We had to file a lawsuit to get on the yard. It was 7 years I was in CCR before I set foot on any soil.
Let me ask you about your mental health and also, you know, what you saw other prisoners go through in terms of their mental health, because you have had, by any measure, a very productive post-prison career. You've been a writer, a speaker internationally. But did everybody get through it? I mean, how difficult was it for you to keep your thoughts together?
I am telling you, it wasn't easy. Because, you know, I did see people come in, and I saw how open they were, and then how after a while they become withdrawn. And I kind of isolated myself when I saw what happened to them. I think it created a steel resolve in myself, you know, to not to succumb to that. So my thoughts, I used to love to think, and I used to love to write. I used to love to exercise. Time just didn't matter to me. anymore, but except one thing, the time that I would, you know, utilize to try to get out of prison.
I asked him if he thinks about his friends and co-plaintiffs who are still inside, Wallace and Woodfox.
Well, I do. I think about them a lot. April 17th will be 41 years that both have been held in solitary-like conditions in Angola. So it'll be 41 years. You know, I think about that. I was there for 29. And when I think about how much longer they have been there, it would be like, what, 12 years longer than I was. And, you know, people ask me this the question all the time, well, why aren't you crazy? You know, and I just kind of laugh. Well, you know, I let them know that way. I didn't tell you I wasn't crazy. You know, I don't think a person could get dipped in waste and not come up smelling. And even though it may not be totally apparent, the impact and the effects are there.
One of the most stated reasons for long-term isolation is that it controls open prison populations. Senator Durbin noted just the opposite, that when Mississippi lowered its use of solitary confinement, violence reduced.
Prison violence went down by 50%, and the cost of incarceration went down. It was a wake-up call to all of us to take a hard look at it. Maybe this just isn't the best way to deal with these problems.
And here's another sobering thought. Standing, locked alone, in one of the old monk-like isolation cells at Eastern State Penitentiary, the feeling is of being adrift on an ice floe. The light comes from a shaft overhead, like an igloo. There's no window, no horizon. Almost 70,000 people passed through Eastern State Penitentiary before it closed its doors as a prison over 40 years ago. That's fewer than the number of people in solitary confinement in America today, the most anywhere in the world. And most of them will one day rejoin society, ready or not.
What is this thing?
It's enormous.
It's an asteroid, sir.
In the 1998 film Armageddon, the character played by Bruce Willis saves the Earth by knocking aside an asteroid headed straight for us. Pure fiction, right? Well, maybe not. Last month's meteor explosion over Russia was a reminder of just how vulnerable we are to those large rocky bodies whizzing by in outer space. Well, we hope they're whizzing by. The Siberian version of Armageddon, though, says, what happens when they don't? Well, scientists are working to protect us. How?
By crashing a spacecraft into an asteroid to change its orbit.
That's Dr. Andrew Chang, chief scientist of the Space Department at Johns Hopkins University's Applied Physics Lab. He's heading up a project that could have been ripped from a Hollywood screenplay. Here's the idea. Shoot a rocket into an asteroid, knock it off course.
The idea is almost the same as what a hockey player does. If there's an opposing player coming at you that you don't want to come too close to your goal, you just go out and hit him with your body and just push him off to the side.
The project is aiming for an asteroid called Didymos, which is Greek for twin, because Didymos is actually two asteroids.
There's a fair number of the near-Earth asteroids which have their own little moons around them. This is one of those. And we're going to target the moon of the asteroid Didymos. We want to pick on the little guy because the little guy is easier to shove around.
Chang says that if Didymos were to hit the Earth, it would cause damage on the scale of a nuclear war. But not to worry. Near Earth is a relative term. Didymos is projected to pass 6.5 million miles away from us, and not for another decade.
We need that much time to get ready, and also to convince the national agencies that this is worth doing.
Right now, the project, named AIDA for Asteroid Impact and Deflection Assessment, is in the conceptual stage, but it has the support of both NASA and the European Space Agency, and, forgive us here, the stars have to align for all that funding to come through. Chang says this is really important, a defense measure.
If, for example, an asteroid were discovered, even a very hazardous one, that were going to hit the Earth, say, in 5 or 6 months, you know, there's nothing we could do to prevent the impact.
As for the impact in Siberia last month, which injured 1,000 people, those kinds of collisions really aren't as rare as one might hope.
That size impact occurs roughly once every 100 years. So we don't know when or where the next impact of that size would happen.
The Bible calls this day Armageddon. For the first time in the history of the planet, a species has the technology to prevent its own extinction.
Okay, Armageddon is just a movie. And while the technology is a work in progress at the Johns Hopkins Applied Physics Lab, Chang won't get to save the planet anytime soon. He says that catastrophic strikes from asteroids the size of mountains only happen once every few million years. Tell that to the dinosaurs. When it's all around you, the propulsive joy of music seems as much a part of the atmosphere as the air. For deaf people, though, this rapture is largely absent. Now, a Welsh symphony orchestra is working to include them. The BBC National Orchestra of Wales has incorporated the deaf into the concert experience with free workshops and performances, and they have the help of a transformative piece of technology called a sound box.
So that people can sit on, lie on, put their feet on, put their hands on, and they can actually feel what the whole symphony orchestra is doing.
That's Andy Pidcock, a freelance musician who works with the orchestra and who helped create the sound box. In a minute, we'll hear from a deaf person about what that's like. But first, Andy Pidcock explains how the box transmits vibrations from each instrument.
The whole orchestra is mic'd up, and that goes straight into the boxes. So you get the whole dynamics of the percussion department, of the strings, the horns, and the double basses. You get all the dynamics that are going on in a symphony orchestra, so you can actually feel those dynamics in your body.
In the Hall of Notting King, this is one of the pieces played through the box. Let's listen to a little bit of it. So that's an example of a piece that starts somewhat subdued and then it almost explodes. So how are different instruments and sounds transmitted differently through the box?
Okay, well, that particular piece just demonstrates just perfectly, really, a lot of the musical building blocks. So it does start quite low, but that's actually a really fantastic way to start because you can feel that. So it's a combination of both a visual, it's using touch, and also just being in the whole environment. So it's a whole body thing. It's much more than just hearing.
Now, this music box is just one part of an outreach project by the National Orchestra of Wales to bring music to those who might otherwise not get a chance to experience it. Tell me a little bit about the whole outreach program.
It's gone on for many years, actually, and we're always trying to find ways of making music and a symphony orchestra accessible, as well as having visual indication of dynamics of the orchestra. We have big screens and we invite audience to come and sit amongst the players. So whilst the orchestra is playing, people can put their hands on the double bass or the violin or the horns and they can actually feel the instruments. And we also invite audience members to conduct the orchestra as well.
Why do you think that's important, Andy, that deaf people be able to experience sound in this way?
I think because music is much more than just sound. And it's about actually being, you know, in a hall with many other people who are also enjoying the same experience. But also traditionally, if, say, the deaf community want to go to a symphony orchestra, it can be quite a passive experience. You go in, maybe try and clap at the right time and then get an ice cream in the break. Whereas this is not that at all. It's quite participatory.
Kate Galloway got to participate and it was a first in a lifetime experience.
I'm a deaf person, never ever experienced an orchestra before.
Kate speaking through interpreter Julie Doyle, and she says when she heard about the free concert, she was a little skeptical.
Well, at first I thought, an orchestra for deaf people? That can't be possible.
But Galloway, who works as an advocate for the deaf, figured it was something she and her clients just couldn't pass up.
We all came as part of a group and we came to experience what this box would be like. And it really was quite a profound experience, something none of us would ever have thought that we would experience.
Kate, what was the sound box like for you? How did it feel?
It's really hard to describe because it is such a new experience. It's really difficult for me to put it into words, like a buzz. It was a buzz. It was vibrating. But I felt that when we were actually part of the orchestra, that was enhanced. And it was a weird, odd, fantastic and new experience. one person did not have the confidence to sit amongst the orchestra. So I said, come along with me, you know, I'll take you along. And was just absolutely stunned by it, actually having a chance to touch the instruments. I think we all just felt that we would never have an experience like it. The word that comes to mind is a buzz, a physical buzz, you know.
Had you considered yourself a music fan before? Was it something that you were interested in trying to feel, or had you made up your mind that that just wasn't going to be part of your life?
Well, I certainly felt that music wasn't for me because I didn't feel it was accessible. When I did get the invitation to attend, I felt, well, this is a chance for me to experience what various parts of the orchestra might feel like and what parts they had to play in creating music. I think if it was just any old orchestra that was for hearing people, I certainly wouldn't have felt that was for me. I would have felt, nope, that's not for deaf people. But I think by creating this visual event, myself and all our deaf clients really found it fascinating, and everyone's been talking about it since. And they're all saying, please, when's the next event? We'd love to have another go at it.
Well, Kate Galloway, Julie Doyle, and Andy Pidcock, musician with the BBC National Orchestra of Wales, speaking to us from Cardiff. Thank you all so much.
Great. Thank you so much. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
There are some who can live without wild things and some who cannot. These essays are the delights and dilemmas of one who cannot.
These are the opening pages of a Sand County Almanac, a collection of essays and observations written decades ago by the father of the American conservation movement, Aldo Leopold.
Like winds and sunsets, wild things were taken for granted until progress began to do away with them. Now we face the question whether a still higher, quote, standard of living is worth its cost in things natural, wild, and free.
The original was published in 1949, a year after Leopold's death. But his groundbreaking writings on conservation and ecology become more relevant with each passing year. This month, the Library of America will publish a special edition of A Sand County Almanac and inspire yet another generation of conservationists. As a teenager, Stan Temple was captivated by Leopold's writing. Now, Temple is professor emeritus in conservation at the University of Wisconsin.
It's like he was so far ahead of his contemporaries that the things he was writing about just before his death really didn't find an audience until 25 years later.
Leopold pioneered the science of ecology using only binoculars and a notebook. He invented wildlife management, and his work is still on the cutting edge of the field even 64 years later. Leopold didn't live to hear the phrase climate change, but his journals are now used by researchers like Temple to gain insight on global warming.
We could use these historical records to put 2012 into context.
Temple realized that by comparing Leopold's observations of springtime in the 1940s to springtime in 2012, researchers could show the speed of climate change.
Flowers had never bloomed so early in Aldo Leopold's data and in Henry David Thoreau's data and indeed in all the subsequent data.
Leopold kept meticulous journals. He'd sit outside on his hand-built bench on his land in southwestern Wisconsin and write about what he saw. Here's one such passage.
The skunk track enters the woods and crosses a glade where the rabbits have packed down the snow. Newly exposed oak seedlings have paid for the thaw with their newly barked stems.
His writings are extremely detailed. What you're listening to now is a recreation Temple made of Leopold's morning soundtrack just by following his journal descriptions, bird by bird.
Leopold is revered for the way he wrote about this place, this wonderful lyrical prose that evokes the dramas that are going on in this landscape that he knew so intimately.
Kurt Miney is Aldo Leopold's biographer. Leopold's words are as relevant as if he'd written them yesterday. Yet he was writing for his own lifetime, which spanned the extinction of the passenger pigeon and the nuclear bombing of Japan.
It was a time of incredible change in the entire landscape. The great forests of the upper Great Lakes were being leveled. The wetlands of the Mississippi River Basin were being drained. Waterfowl and other wildlife were being depleted. The prairies of the Midwest, of course, were being converted over into agriculture.
In Leopold's youth, Teddy Roosevelt was president, and environmental preservation was a national discussion for the first time. Leopold's father taught him how to hunt and respect the land, and later, Aldo Leopold would graduate from the Yale School of Forestry and join the Forest Service as a ranger. And on that job, in the mountains of southeastern Arizona, Leopold had an experience that shaped his thinking for the next 30 years. Again, biographer Kurt Meine.
One of the most significant episodes occurs right at the outset of his career when he shoots a wolf.
Leopold wrote about this in one of his most famous essays.
We reached the old wolf in time to watch a fierce green fire dying in her eyes. I realized then and have known ever since that there was something new to me in those eyes, something known only to her and to the mountain.
Killing the wolf triggered Leopold's introspective mind. He realized that preserving land wasn't enough. We had to work to actively protect it. In the 1930s, Leopold witnessed the destruction of agriculture and overdevelopment. The Dust Bowl devastated the land and deepened the Great Depression. He turned his thoughts now to the idea of restoration. So the Leopold family bought a piece of ravaged land in Baraboo, Wisconsin, and set about rejuvenating it. Kurt Meine and Stan Temple took me out on the Leopold land on a snowy sub-zero day to see the landscape from Leopold's old cabin.
We're coming up to the shack.
But let's pause for a moment, because what you see, anything that's living here, any plants living, were not here in Leopold's day, pretty much. So we just walked through a little woods, a mixture of pines and oaks. All the pines you see were planted. But right out in front of us here is one of the earliest experiments in ecological restoration we have.
Leopold's experiment started by planting his beloved pine trees, 50,000 over his lifetime. Every spring, he'd drag the family to this little shack, and they'd plant trees and write journals to record the evolution of the land.
Lock is frozen. There we go.
And here, inside this tiny bare-bone shack, a converted chicken coop, Leopold wrote his land ethic. The essay argues for responsible, ethical treatment of nature, which became the core of modern conservation.
In short, a land ethic changes the role of Homo sapiens from conqueror of the land community to plain member and citizen of it. It implies respect for his fellow members and also respect for the community as such.
If Aldo Leopold could participate today in the public debate over hydrofracking, mountaintop removal, and carbon emissions, he would say that these challenges are what the land ethic is for. It's inconceivable to me, he wrote, that an ethical relationship to the land can exist without love, respect, and admiration, and a high regard for its value. Krista Paravani and her sister, Kara, were identical twins. And then, when they were 28, they were no longer together. Kara died of a drug overdose. Krista spiraled into depression. As Krista Paravani explores in her new memoir, Her, what the two women shared was a bond of sisterhood that went beyond blood into the elliptical world of twinhood, inhabiting one shared soul. Both were artists, one a writer, the other a photographer. Both married early. Both lived through a hard-scrabble childhood with a troubled mother. Her is the story of what happened to Krista Paravani before and after the death of a twin, both beloved and impossible.
Everyone that knew my sister always said the same thing about her, and they said, she was a good girl. By the way, they never said that about me. They always said that about Kara. She was a complicated and also impossible woman, as you had mentioned, yeah.
28 when she died.
She was 28 when she overdosed, yeah.
The undertaking of this book, the two of you are together on the page here, but you really had been so together in this sort of isolated childhood. Tell me about this doubling. Is it impossible to remember how long ago you felt like that? Was it from the beginning that you did?
It was from the beginning. There's a way in which people just respond to you as one person. You're the girls.
Identical twins.
Identical
of course.
Twins. Yeah. As a result, we actually remembered things that happened to our twin, that happened to us. Or wait, does that make sense?
Yes, I think it does. Yeah. So it isn't happening just to one person. It's reverberating.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I can. I am very sure that I kissed Chad Taylor, for example. But I know for sure that Kara kissed Chad Taylor.
This is the first kiss.
Yes,
you're 13
this was Kara's first kiss when she was 13 years old, and she told me with such gusto that I can tell you that I did it myself.
When you open this book, Krista Parivani, this great diversion in your lives take place after all those years of twinning. And maybe you could talk about that. And that is this terrible attack on your sister. She's about 24.
She had just moved to a small town in Massachusetts to begin her graduate studies in creative writing. And one afternoon, she went out and walked her dog in a park near her home, and she met a man in the woods, and he raped her, and it was a many hours attack. She emerged a changed woman, and I think that she was surprised that she survived that attack. And in a way, she felt that she hadn't survived, that she'd left part of herself on the forest floor that day.
And it leaves her psychologically really damaged, deafened in one ear, as you say, never quite the same person.
Honestly, writing the scene, I tried to write that rape for 6 weeks in this book. I tried my hardest to inhabit that space for my sister. And this miraculous thing happened. I went to visit my mom's house, and I decided that I was going to go upstairs and spend some time with my sister's things. And I sat down, and I looked under her bed, and there was this Tupperware, and I pulled it out, and inside of it was this notebook that my sister had left behind with the complete account of her rape. And I was really grateful to have it and to be able to publish it in the book that way. And because I had felt at that moment, too, and that we had been so separated and that I couldn't understand what she had been through, it was a magical experience, really, to be able to have her to deliver that to me.
There's this really redeeming moment, if you will, when after this terrible day, she's gone to the hospital, she's been released, you actually are giving her a bath. It's like a new baptism almost.
Yeah. My sister insisted that I wash her clean after the attack. We had this very intimate moment together in the bathtub. I was fully clothed, and I took a washcloth, and I gently cleaned the marks on her back that her assailant had left with his teeth. And I'll never forget that moment, and I also think it was a gift that my sister gave me to allow me into the room with her that way. It was truly the only moment I felt during that entire week where I knew that I was being helpful and loving in a way that she needed.
I'm speaking with Krista Parivani. Her new book is a memoir. It's called Her, and it's out this week. She's really spiraling into the drug addiction that eventually steals her life. After she's defended her MFA, she's in your bathroom getting high, shooting up, right?
She was.
And that's where you say, I don't want to see you till you're in rehab.
Yeah, I thought that would do it. I thought maybe finally if I put my foot down and said, you need to get help, that she would go get it. Because her worst fear was that I was no longer going to be with her. To be linked as twins, leaving the bond is something that feels like an act of infidelity. And I felt incredibly guilty.
After her death, what happens to you? You stumble yourself, I mean, badly, never as dark as your sister. But your life begins to really spin out of control.
It did. I gave up in a lot of ways. I think that people who are facing the prospect of losing their loved ones to an addiction are always preparing themselves for the death of that person, rehearsing, if you will, their feelings before it happens. But when I learned
Because there's so much narcissism in an addiction. You just can't get through.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much narcissism in addiction. And in twinship, you're seeing yourself and that person, and they're seeing themselves and you the whole time. And it's this vicious circle of a built-in narcissism in twinship anyway. So when the addiction came in, there was absolutely no room left for me. And sometimes I thought, maybe it will be easier for me when she dies. But of course, I learned very quickly after she died that that was not true. And I wasn't prepared for looking in the mirror, for example, and seeing my sister staring back at me. Our whole lives being twins, I had wanted to differentiate myself from her, but once she died, there was no way for me to see myself without seeing her. And it wasn't always that dark. For example, when I laughed, I could hear her, and that was a nice way of having her visit.
You also read at her funeral a prayer that had been at her wedding, and it's the Sufi prayer. It says, I offer you peace, I offer you joy, I offer you friendship, and it ends, I honor that source in you. And I would say you have honored it in yourself as well.
Thank you.
Krista Parravani's new memoir is called Her. She joined us here in our studio in New York. Krista, it's been a great pleasure and honor.
Thank you.
On this show, we've been asking filmmakers about the movies that they could watch again and again, including this one from a former Saturday Night Live staff writer.
Hello, my name is Emily Spivey. I'm a comedy writer, and the movie I've seen a million times is 9 to 5, written and directed by Colin Higgins, starring Jane Fonda, Lily Tomlin, Dolly Parton, and Dabney Coleman. Working 9 to 5. I saw it in the theater in 1980, and I'll never forget how packed the theater was and how hard people were laughing. Like, you hear the term rolling in the aisles. People were literally rolling in the aisles. And at the time, I kind of got it, but not really. I was like 8. And then as I got a little older, I really got hooked on it. I've been watching this movie my whole life, over and over and over. I swear. I think I would describe it as a workplace comedy where women really triumph.
Mel, no, that's 2, 10, net 30, delivered in 9 days. That's 2% of 440, 550 is 8811. Oh, my pleasure, Mel.
I love the performances.
Okay, I'm going to leave, but I'm going to tell you one thing before I go. Don't you ever refer to me as your girl again.
What in God's name are you talking about?
I'll tell you what I'm talking about. I'm no girl. I'm a woman. Do you hear me? I'm not your wife or your mother.
And then I adore Dolly Parton. I think she's an amazing comedy actress. I think she's super underrated. And she's just a real charmer in this movie.
Look, I got a gun out there in my purse. And up to now, I've been forgiven and forgetting because of the way I was brought up. But I'll tell you one thing. If you ever say another word about me or make another indecent proposal, I'm going to get that gun of mine. And I'm going to change you from a rooster to a hen with one shot.
My favorite scene in 9 to 5 is when Dabney Coleman, who plays Franklin Hart, is really coming on to Dora Lee, who's played by Dolly Parton.
I got something on my dress?
Nothing is wrong. As a matter of fact, everything is very, very right.
She's his secretary. She can't help how voluptuous she is, and he can't help to be his cad self. So he's arranging his pencils and pens on his desk so that when she comes in to, quote, take a memo, he's going to dump those pens on the floor and look down her dress.
Oh, the pencils, yeah.
It's all right. I'll get it.
Then in the fantasy sequence in the second act, she has Franklin Hart stand up, turn around.
Just hold it right there.
Something wrong?
No, nothing's wrong. I just want to check your bod. Turn around for a second.
My favorite thing that Dabney Coleman's ever done is when she asks him what kind of cologne he's wearing.
Stuff's turning me on. What's that called?
And the name of the cologne is Stud.
Stud?
I've rewound him saying the word stud so many times. Because he seems so scared and so embarrassed. And it's just really satisfying. Those fantasy sequences are so, on paper, broad and corny, but then when you see them, you're just so buying into it. And it's so funny. And as a woman, it really showed me that women are just as hysterical and funny as men.
That's writer Emily Spivey talking about the movie that she could watch a million times, 9 to 5. Spivey created the NBC TV show Up All Night with Maya Rudolph and Christina Applegate.
Well,
Well, you probably know what that sound means. After 4 weeks and over 4,000 stories, we've finally reached the end of round 10 of our 3-Minute Fiction contest. I'm Guy Raz. I'm the curator of 3-Minute Fiction here on Weekends and All Things Considered, and also the host of the TED Radio Hour on NPR. 3-Minute Fiction is, of course, our contest where we ask you, our listeners, to come up with an original short story that can be read in about 3 minutes. The challenge this round was to write a story in the form of a voicemail message. And I have to say, we got some pretty amazing, interesting messages in return. That challenge was given to us by our judge this round, the novelist Mona Simpson, who is with us now to talk about her pick for the winning entry in this round of 3-Minute Fiction. Mona, welcome. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
So, first of all, you came up with this amazing challenge, which was to write a short story under 600 words in the form of a voicemail message. Give me a sense of what came in, what you saw people do with this.
There was a great variety, and it was surprising voicemail messages. I mean, some were hilarious. Two in particular that I keep thinking of. One is called Everything's Under Control.
Oh, yeah.
By Eric Bronner.
Eric Bronner of Eugene, Oregon.
Which is about a fellow who works for the zoo who released an elephant for unknown reasons and then lost him and is trying to strategize the elephant's recapture from his one phone call from jail. Uh-huh. It's very funny. And another one I keep thinking of called After the Tone by Jackie Higgins Daly from Phoenix. She's leaving this message for her boyfriend about their complete incompatibility. And she saw somebody walking a dog, and the dog was just straining and straining and straining to go faster. And the man was pulling him back with all his might. And she saw that as their relationship.
Mona, we, of course, can only pick one story out of the more than 4,000
that
we received this round. So who is it? Who is the winner for round 10 of 3-Minute Fiction?
Well, the great story is called Sorry for Your Loss, and it's by Lisa Rubinson.
Oh, wow. What was it about this story that struck you?
It's funny at moments, and yet it's very strikingly yearning, and it's a story which the caller keeps revising her messages. I mean, we only get the message that's actually finally left. We don't get the 5 erasures and trials. And I love the way she considers these various things she wants to say, but erases them and what she finally comes to.
Well, without any further ado, here is Lisa Rubinson's story, Sorry for Your Loss. It's read by NPR's Tamara Keith.
Please record your message after the tone. When you have finished, you may hang up or press the pound key for more options.
Hi, it's me, Christine. I can't believe you still have this number, that I still remember it. But there's your voice on the machine, like no time has passed. I'm so sorry for your loss, Nick, for your mom. Can anyone else hear this?
To re-record your message, press 3.
Hi, Nick. It's Christine. Christine Williams. Remember? It's been a long time. I called because I know it's tough right now. I'm sorry to hear about the death of that your mom passed. Try to say something real.
To re-record your message, press 3.
Nick, it's Christine. Hey, long time no anything. Too jaunty.
To re-record your message, press...
Hi, Nick. It's Christine. Stacy told me about your mom. It was in the paper here, too. How are you? What a thing to say. I'm sorry for everything. Your mom and I, well, whatever, you know. But I was still fond of her. Is that what I was?
To re-record your message, press...
Nick, it's Chris. I'm so sorry. I'm in town, and I wanted to come over, bring you dinner or something. Stacy said you're single again. I left that guy. You called it. Huh. Maybe now we can... No, please, no. Let me press the right button here.
To re-record your message...
Nick, it's me, Chris. Christine, I'm sorry about your mom. I've been thinking about you. About her. For some reason, about the time she picked up the phone and said, you two are too young to be this serious. Remember how he laughed as she spit out the words two and two? I tried so hard to get her to like me. It's weird. I have a daughter now. She's the same age we were. Can you imagine? Can you imagine?
Ugh. To re-record your message.
Christine, it's Nick, love of your life. Nice.
To re-record your...
Hi, Nick. It's Christine. It's been so long. I'm in town. Listen, I'm sorry to hear about your mom. I'll never forget the house on Del Cielo. Her garden with those ocotillos with the octopus arms and the squat prickly pears in front of the gate. How we said she planted them to keep girls like me away.
to re-record your...
Nick, it's Chris. I'm in town. Would love to see you. I'm sorry about your mom. It's so hard to find the right words. I'm rambling, nervous, so much to say. I keep thinking about the old days. It's weird. I have a teenager now, a daughter the same age as we were. I think about us, and it's hard. I think about skiing and finding that circle of pine trees, about pretending the clouds were our kids and giving them all Greek god names, about sitting at dinner with our faces bright red. Your mom thought we were up to something, but we were just burned from the sun and the wind and the future shining down hard all around us.
To re-record...
It's me. I'm in town. I'm sorry.
To re-record your message, press...
It's me. Call me back, please. This is Christine.
To send your message, press the pound key.
Wow. That story by Lisa Rubinson from Charlotte, North Carolina, and she is with us now on the line from WFAE in Charlotte. Lisa, what an amazing story. Congratulations to you.
Yes, congratulations. I love this story.
Oh, thank you. Thank you both.
I mean, you heard Mona's prompt a few weeks ago on the show, and how did you figure out to write such an amazing, moving piece like that?
I thought it was a great prompt, and it was a lot of fun to think about what are the things that you would try to say in a voicemail that were so important and yet could still be said kind of naturally. There's always things that need to be said but aren't, or things that get said that shouldn't. And I struggle with that a lot, and I think it's a kind of a universal thing. So that's kind of what started me down that path.
What I love about it is it's very, very sad and poignant, but it's also hilariously funny. The revisions are hilarious. She first is sort of fumbling to get to the three button to make sure she can actually erase what she's just said. And then she gets good at it and kind of gets going and sort of lets herself leave messages that she knows she's not going to allow, that she knows she's going to erase. So even though it's a vocal story, we get the privilege of hearing her thinking as well to herself.
Do you have any questions that you wanted to ask Mona?
Oh, my goodness. I would love to talk about writing all day with you and storytelling, and I think it may be a little bit of a cliche, but I would love to just ask the question that new writers are always asking. How do you start when you sit down to write something? How do you talk to your characters? How do they start coming into the world with you?
That's a good question. You know, I've been writing for a long time, and I think for me it's almost a kind of a meditative practice. Characters come to me as sort of compounds or exaggerations of things I see in life, something I'll read.
Great words of advice from Mona Simpson, our judge. This round, round 10 of 3 Minute Fiction. I can't believe we're already at round 10. The winner this time around was Lisa Rubinson from Charlotte, North Carolina. Her story, Sorry for Your Loss, can be found on our website. That's npr.org/3MinuteFiction. That story will also be published in the next issue of the Paris Review. Our friends at the Paris Review have agreed to publish that story, and Lisa will also receive a signed copy of Mona Simpson's latest book, My Hollywood. Lisa, thank you so much. Congratulations on such an amazing story.
Thank you. It's really quite an honor.
And, of course, thanks to our judge this round, round 10 of 3 Minute Fiction, the novelist Mona Simpson. Mona, what a great challenge. It was great having you. Thank you so much.
Oh, it was my delight. It was really fun reading them.
That's our judge, writer Mona Simpson, and special thanks to Guy Raz, curator of 3 Minute Fiction and now host of the TED Radio Hour. And thanks to our wonderful readers, the graduate students at 14 creative writing programs across the country who helped us wade through those 4,000 stories. We appreciate everybody's help. And 3 Minute Fiction fans, stay tuned for a whole new round with a new judge, new prompt, coming soon to a radio near you. And it's time now for music.
Did I just hear an alarm start ringing?
That's actor Norbert Leo Butz from the 2002 cast recording of the musical The Last 5 Years. The Last 5 Years won Drama Desk Awards for Best Music and Best Lyrics and became a cult hit, with stagings of the musical showing up all over the country. It's even being made into a film. Now, 11 years later, the show's composer, Jason Robert Brown, is bringing his musical back to where it all began, New York City.
When I was 32, when the piece originally opened, it was a very personal piece to me, and I felt like it was sort of my life at that moment. And this point later, I have a much more, what I would call, avuncular interest in the characters. I kind of want to tell them that it's okay, that it's going to work out, and that this happens to everybody, and we all understand.
The story at the center of the last 5 years is simple.
It's really an exploration of two people who meet in New York City and fall in love and get married and then fall out of love. So it just examines their relationship over the course of 5 years.
Now, it's not your standard musical because the storyline shifts a lot. It moves forwards and it moves backwards. And the last 5 years, the narrator is Kathy's story primarily. We see it through her eyes. Jamie's is the next 5 years. They have duets just in the middle when they get married.
Structurally, the piece works so that Kathy is always moving backwards through time, whereas Jamie is always moving forwards. And then they do meet in the middle at their wedding.
Let's hear a little bit from that.
Will you share your life with me for the next 10 minutes? For the next 10 minutes, we can handle that. We could watch the waves. We could watch the sky. Or just sit and wait as the time ticks by. And if we make it till then, can I ask you again for another 10?
It's so sweet. That's actor Adam Cantor singing the next 10 minutes from the revival of your show, The Last 5 Years. I think one of the things that's such a hook here is that this idea of telling Jamie and Kathy's story, imploding the traditional love story where they ride off into the sunset, is unorthodox and perhaps a lot more like life. How did it come to you? I know it's partly autobiographical.
Well, what I always say is it's not autobiographical, but, you know, I had a tumultuous first marriage and certainly a lot of that went into the writing of this show. I think that really, though, the show started more as a structural conceit to me. The idea was to write a two-character piece. I wanted to do something small. And I wanted to tell a simple story so that I could have fairly expansive songs. I feel like when you have a lot of story that has to get told, the songs have to be very short or they have to always be doing plot. And I don't think songs do plot very well. And once I came up with the idea that it should be a love story just between two people, I thought that if it went in chronological order, if it was she sings a song and he sings a song, I thought we would always sort of be ahead of them. You know, I didn't know quite where that was going to end up. And then it came to me on a subway platform that if she were going backwards and he were going forwards, that we'd know what the end of the story was, but we would always be a little bit struggling with them. You know, we would just be in the middle of their struggle to get together and to figure out what went wrong. And I thought that psychologically actually made sense to me. That felt like what it was to be at the end of a marriage, is you just sort of, everyone was in a different time.
You share your life with me
forever,
for the next 10 lifetimes,
forever,
for a million summers,
till the world explodes, till there's no one left who has ever known.
It's a show about trying to be an artist in New York City and trying to be in love at the same time and how those are sometimes in conflict.
One of the standout things about this musical is its wit. Let's listen to Adam Cantor sing another song, and this one's called Shiksa Goddess.
If you had a tattoo, that wouldn't matter. If you had a shaved head, that would be cool. If you came from Spain or Japan or the back of a van, just as long as you're not from a Hebrew school, I'd say now I'm getting somewhere. I'm finally breaking through. I'd say, hey, hey, Shiksa Goddess, I've been waiting for someone like you.
A tiny sort of Woody Allen touch there, I think. You know, as a writer, how do you balance comedy and drama?
Comedy is drama. I think that if your characters are feeling something that is very real, then they have to respond in a way that feels real to them. And some situations, the only response you could possibly have is to respond in a way that's so extreme that people are going to laugh. You know, these characters are in crisis for much of the show. And that sense of crisis, you know, either propels great angst and great upset, or sometimes the release is just to start cracking jokes about it.
Jason, I know you grew up just outside New York City. Did you always know you wanted to compose music?
What I always wanted to do was to be a rock star. I thought I was going to be Billy Joel, which I think for all Jewish boys who played piano in the suburbs back then, that was kind of the goal. And, you know, I went down that path for a while, and at the same time, you know, I loved theater music, and I listened to West Side Story religiously, and I sort of, you know, grew up just outside of the city, and so went to Broadway shows once or twice a year. And so it sort of seemed logical to me that I could write musicals as well as being a rock star. But then the rock star thing I never really pursued.
At a really young age, you were doing this kind of thing and thinking this way.
Yeah, well, you know, I did musicals in high school, certainly, and then I just kept wanting to do them. I felt at home in the theater in that way that, you know, you're supposed to if that's the kind of person you are. I showed up in one of those places where you could smell the sawdust and, you know, there was the ghost lights and all the dancers auditioning, and I just thought, oh, right, no, this is home. I get this. And I've never lost that.
I'm speaking with composer Jason Robert Brown. He's directing a revival of his musical, The Last 5 Years, at the Second Stage Theater in New York for a limited run. This show has been internationally successful, just made so many headlines, performed by high school students everywhere. All you have to do is go to YouTube to see how much this piece has been done. And it launched some really great careers, like that of Norbert Leo Butz, who went on to star in Wicked and Dirty Rotten Scoundrels. Not a Broadway show, though. Is it a question of scale, or why do you think it hasn't been done on Broadway?
You know, it may yet, but I think that the economics of doing a show on Broadway are daunting, first of all. And I didn't want the pressure of this show to be dictated by the size of the house. And I think you do write differently for every venue. You know, if you're writing Wicked, you're writing for a very large theater. But if you're writing a piece that's got two people in it and six musicians, you're actually writing for a very intimate space. And I think you have to be careful to preserve that original intention. Broadway is very important. I mean, Broadway, to me, is such an imprimatur on a piece of theater. When, you know, 13, which is another show I wrote, I think has so much of its life now because we were fortunate enough to be on Broadway.
Yes, so you've had the experience of both.
I have, but the last 5 years never needed that. And I've always been very happy with the way that it ran when it was in New York because I felt like it was in the right space.
Came home.
And now it has come home, yes.
And you were telling those young people in the first blush, the first iteration, if you will, of Last 5 Years, that life would work out, and it sounds like it has.
Well, yeah, I mean, what I always say is that, you know, my current wife, Georgia, is the only person who thinks that the last 5 years has a really happy ending.
You had your big opening night this past week. How'd it go?
I think it went pretty well, actually. I was very, very happy with it. I mean, to be a first-time director in New York is a little bit terrifying, and I have two extraordinary young actors, and they just stood up there, and they made my work sing, and I couldn't be happier than seeing that.
And goodbye until tomorrow. Goodbye until the next time you call, and
That's Jason Robert Brown. He's the writer, composer, and director of The Last 5 Years, which is currently playing at the Second Stage Theater in New York. Jason Robert Brown, it has been a real delight talking to you. Thanks for being with us.
Such a pleasure, Jackie. Thank you.
I have been waiting for you.
And for the week ending March 10th, 2013, that's the podcast edition of Weekends and All Things Considered, the best of our programs from Saturday and Sunday. The staff includes Phil Harrell, Becky Hersher, Liz Baker, Amy Held, Lily Percy, and Acacia Squires. Our interns are Annie Russell and Rachel Rood. The technical director is Rob Berman. Mithoni Maturi is senior editor. Steve Lichtai is our senior producer. And I'm Jackie Lydon. We'll be back next week with more of the best stories and features from All Things Considered on the weekends. And remember, you can always hear the show on your local public radio station. Thanks for listening.
Until tomorrow, goodbye. Until my feet touch the floor, and I will be waiting. I will be waiting.
I called Elise to help me pack my bags. I went downtown and closed the bank account. It's not about another shrink. It's not about another compromise. I'm not the only one who's hurting here. I don't know what the hell is left to do. You never saw how far the crack had opened. You never knew I had run out of rope. And I could never rescue you. All you ever wanted, but I could never rescue you. No matter how I tried, all I could do was love you hard and let you go.
Just close the gate.